Okay, it's 11:10. Let's get started. To begin with, there's somebody from CompSoc who'd like to come down and make an announcement.
Hi guys, I'm the first year representative for CompSoc, and I'd just like to say the student bit tech meetup is on tonight. I'll post a little thing on the Max One Facebook group just so some more details, but it's on tonight, and afterwards they are going to the pub, so I highly recommend everyone go along and join. That's all I wanted to say. It's on tonight. Thanks.
So there's a Technium, what is that?
It's the student tech meetup where companies come and give presentations to all the students and stuff with CompSoc. Just to sort of provide a little thing of what you can do after you finish your course and get some business experience and stuff. Is that okay?
Okay. Thank you. So after yesterday's lecture, a few people came up to me and asked very good questions. I said, gosh, I wish you'd asked that during class. So I'm going to give them a chance to ask it during class. So are there any good questions? Come on, I know there are two good questions out there. Can't quite recognize the faces in all these lovely faces this morning. Nobody's going to ask the questions I said, you should ask that. Now, this is very embarrassing. I scared them away. Let's see if I can remember what the very good questions were. So, right, the first very good question was somebody said, does this actually work, right? What do I type in? And the answer is for something like season, you type in exactly what's on the page, and that will exactly work. Now, for something like bool, if you type this in, Haskell will actually get upset. Do people understand how and why it will get upset? Because it already knows about bool. It says, you can't define bool. Somebody's already defined bool. So this one won't work just because exactly this definition is already part of the Haskell standard prelude. Right? This will work perfectly. This will work perfectly. This first bit will work perfectly. You can do all that. This second bit, right, there's nothing, no data to type in because the data type declaration for empty list and cons is built in to Haskell. This you can type in and it will work perfectly. This, of course, is again built in, so you can't type it in. And somebody also pointed out a subtlety between the difference in the way these two work. Right here, we've actually defined a new data type NAT, right, which is one way of representing the natural numbers in Haskell. It's a very inefficient way, right? Because we're going to use, if we try to represent the number a million, we'll have a million successor constructors applied to the zero constructor. So it takes about a million words of computer memory to represent the word a million, right? If you want to represent numbers concisely, the way you could do it, say, is as a list of Booleans, right? We've already seen how to represent lists and Booleans, right? For list of Booleans, up to a million is what, 20 bits? So a list of 20 Booleans would represent all numbers up to 2 to the 20th power, which is a bit more than a million. So this is the simple, inefficient way. You can also do it a more complicated, more efficient way. The tricky bit, which somebody pointed out, is if you look at this definition of add, it's perfectly sensible, right? If I'm trying to add two numbers, it will define that in terms of adding two numbers where one of them is a bit smaller. So eventually it will terminate in the way we've seen. Just like list, you define an operation on lists on recursively on the tail of the list. So the list gets smaller and smaller, and the definition is well defined. This definition is well defined in exactly that way. They point out that this definition is not well defined in exactly that way, because of course plus one is defined in terms of plus, and this would fail as a proper definition of plus if it didn't already know what plus one meant. So if you tried to type this in, of course, we'll get into trouble, for the same reasons before, the computer will say, no, 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 you can't define plus. Plus is already defined. So this way of defining plus in terms of successor makes sense. If we actually defined a successor as plus one, then it wouldn't make sense. You can't define plus in terms of plus in that way. But I just wrote this as a way of showing you what this means. Now, did that clarify things or did that make people more confused? Nobody's nodding. It made everybody more confused. Yes, question. No. Right, you can't put this in, so adding things to it still doesn't make any sense. Right? The stupid computer says, I know what plus is. You can't tell me I know. So there's no point in defining plus in this way. On the other hand, it doesn't know what add is. So you can tell it about add. If you want to do a proper recursive definition, I think this is the right way to do it. You don't want to try to mix this predefined notation for plus with defining your own plus. Does that answer the question? Yeah. Backquoted add is fine, of course. That's right, so don't do it that way. Do successor of n, and then it will be fine. Okay, and then we saw how to do expression trees. So we're going to get on now. I'm going to show you how to do your computation and logic homework. Okay. Any other good questions people want to ask before I go into that? Okay, here we go. Here's how you do your computation and logic homework. So we saw how to define expression trees. We're going to do something very similar. A proposition is going to be we're going to pick seven things. It's a variable. It's false, it's true, it's the negation of a proposition, so not written in front of a proposition, or. So here I've written the symbol for or, and you remember if it's a constructor, it has to be spelled beginning with a capital, and the way we spell constructors that are operators is we begin them with a colon. So I've picked colon, vertical bar, colon for or, and colon, ampersand, colon for and. You don't have to have the colon on the end. I've just done it because it looks a bit nicer. And I've added these lines here. Right. I won't explain this till next week. But I've added these lines deriving eq and ord. And what that means is that equality and less than are automatically defined on this type. So we'll see how that works next week. But if you didn't want to, you could just define eq prop in the same way that we defined things like show prop, and we defined equality over shapes. Right, we defined eq shape in this way. You could define something similarly to define eq prop if you wanted to. And we'll see next week how saying deriving gives you that definition automatically. Notice that we're including variables, and I'm writing a variable just as a name, which is going to be a string. So that we'll use this for propositional variables like p and q. So if I want to write p and q, do I have an example? Not yet. Here's some examples. If I wanted to write the proposition a and b, or not a and not b, right, I would just construct that using var a, var b, the and constructor, the OR constructor, and the NOT constructor. And so this proposition, we'll show how to print that out in a minute, but it corresponds to this string in the logic. Well, I've written tilde there for not, because the little negation sign isn't a symbol on the computer. And remember that these are really parse trees. So when I write that, it stands for the tree, right? The topmost operator is OR. Then we have two AND operators underneath it. And then we have NOT operators underneath both the things on the right, sorry, not on the left. Right, and then here we have the variable A, the variable B. So this is the parse tree corresponding to proposition P0. Sorry, the expression tree corresponding to expression P0. Okay, any questions about P0? You see how that follows from what we did before? So now what would we want to do with a proposition? Well, we might want to convert it to a string so that we can show it. So we'll show the variable x as just x. We'll show false and true as the letters f and t. And we'll show negation by writing out a tilde symbol and then showing the remainder of the proposition. And we'll surround that with parentheses. So par s just puts parentheses around something. And then to show OR and, we just show the two components with either an or an AND between them. Notice I've chosen to write OR and as bar and ampersand, not as colon bar colon or colon ampersand colon. Right? I could have put AND in there if I wanted to, with some spaces around it. You can put anything there you want. Okay, is it clear how this works? Now, notice how recursion is absolutely essential to this. And notice how the structure of this definition follows exactly from the recursion in the definition of prop. So we've said a prop, right? These three clauses aren't recursive. They're not defined in terms of prop. Prop is either a variable followed by a string, or false, or true. Or it's not followed by another proposition. It's two propositions connected with or it's two propositions connected with AND. So we defined propositions in terms of other smaller propositions. And you can see that exactly in this tree, where here's OR, and it has two other propositions as its argument. One built with each, as it happens, built with AND, and so on. So propositions are built up out of smaller propositions recursively. And then that you can follow exactly that pattern when defining things. So this is very important when you want to write a recursive definition on a recursive data type. You can read off the form of that definition from the declaration of the data type. So here, right, we had seven cases, I think. No, six. One, two, three, four, five, six. Six cases. There will be six lines, one for each constructor. And for the constructor AND, say, both of its arguments are propositions. So we just write variables for each of those, P and Q. And then we recursively call the function we're defining on each of those subtrees. So we convert the subtrees to strings and then combine those strings to give the string that represents the whole proposition. You've seen this idea that the data type gives you a very good guide as to what to write before, because we know when we're trying to write a recursive definition over a list, in the usual case, there are two possibilities, right? We define the function over the empty list. We define the function over cons. And you can read that off the definition for list here, right? There are two cases, empty list and cons, And there are two cases that we've written in the definition here, empty list and cons. Isn't this lovely? 90% of the time, you can work out exactly what your function definition looks like just by looking at the data type definition. So the data type definition gives you a huge clue as to what to write for the function definition. Right? This is why I love typed functional programming, because it's easy. Because from the data type, you can read off what you're supposed to do. That is such a lovely idea. It can be a little bit hard to appreciate how wonderful that is, right? When you start to learn Java, you'll realize it's not always so easy. But here, it's very easy. Notice that you want this program to be as general as possible, right? We can write patterns that go many deep. So we could have said, oh, well, I'll show you how to write something that is, say, right? I need to be able to write out, whoops. The control for the right board. Most common error on final. So pay attention. I'll jump up and down to wake people up who are asleep, okay? Don't do this! I have marked lots and lots and lots of finals exams where people have done this. Don't do this. It's a very common error. So the statement of the final will say something like, here is P0, and here is the result of printing P0. And then people need to write the program show prop. And they write a clause for show prop that looks like this. Get the right number of closes here. Oops, nope, I've got the wrong number of closes here. There. There, that's all the problem. And then what is it going to be? It's going to be, in fact, you need lots of open parentheses, don't you? And then you need an X. And then we need a close parenthesis and an OR, and a couple of open parentheses and a NOT. So they'll write something out like this. So I say, right, when it matches this pattern, it gives you this result, which is true. But I think the definition should look like that. So why is this a bad line to put in the definition? Yes? It works for just this one case, right? It works for any variables x, y, u, and v, but only propositions of this structure and nothing else, okay? This works for every possible proposition. That's the first reason not to do it. But there's a second reason not to do it. But this is just a special case, right? It's quite complicated to read. This is all nice and simple. And this handles every proposition there is. How many propositions are there? An infinite number! More than you could ever write down. Even if everybody in this class was trying to write them down and you all wrote different ones, you still couldn't write all of them down in the time of one exam. You couldn't write all of them down in your lifetime. There are lots of them. Okay? But these six lines define it for every possible proposition. Do it this way, you'll be spending your whole life doing it. Do it this way, and you've got it all done very quickly. Do it this way, you'll get very low marks on the exam. Right? There's a special thing on my mark sheet for the exams that says, if it's done like this, give very few marks. Do it this way, and you will get perfect marks. Okay? Clear enough? So don't do unnecessary special cases. Use recursion. Here it is, recursion. Recursion! Use recursion. Any questions about that? Is that clear enough? Okay. So that's how to do show, right? What else might we want to do? We might want to find all the different names mentioned in a proposition, right? That's very important because let's say we want to make a truth table for the proposition, right? If you have a truth table with three variables in it, how many lines will your truth table have? 8, right? 2 cubed. 2 times 2 times 2. Right? If you have 5 variables, how many lines will your truth table have? 32. Right? So I saw a hand up.
Just about the special cases.
Yes?
Will Haskell actually have an error if you have redundant cases?
No. Haskell is perfectly happy to let you write down redundant cases. Sometimes, if efficiency is really important, you might need to write down redundant cases. Or sometimes you actually have special cases that behave differently.
But if they behave differently, then it wouldn't be a case of two things taking the same input and eventually just coming out with the same output.
That's right, but Haskell, if you write two equations, the stupid computer just uses the first one that works. It doesn't look at the two and go, oh, these are both doing the same thing. It just uses the first one that works. Okay. So, no, Haskell won't warn you if you've done something stupid. Okay. So we want to find all the different free variables in an expression. How many different free variables are there in our P0? One, two, three, four. They're four, right? How many people think it's four? Very few hands going up. How many people think it's three? Two. Ooh, lots of votes for two. One. Okay, lots of votes for two. Quite a few hands didn't go up. You're reluctant to commit yourselves. Okay, so like the majority of the class, I believe there are two here, right? A and B. And these are the same A and B, so we only count them once. So how are we going to do that? So clearly, if we've got something that's just var of x, there's one, x. So we return a list of one thing. How many free variables are there in the expression false? Right, not very many. So I've returned a list of no free variables. Similarly for true. By the way, why have I written false and true as f and t rather than false and true? Sorry? Right, false and true are of course already defined in Haskell, so I can't try to define them again. So that's why I've used different names, f and t. How many names are there in not p? Well, they will be the same as the names in p. And then finally, if I have something like or and, right, use recursion. Find the names and the parts. Each of these will be a list. We can just combine the lists with plus plus. And then what's this nub doing here? Okay, how many people know what the nub function does? Oh, wow, almost all of you, great. So the nub function just takes a list and returns a list removing duplicates. So if we give nub the list A, B, A, B, it will return the list AB. If we give NUB the list AAAAAAAA, it will return the list A. Yes? So where is NUB? Is NUB in the list library or in the standard prelude? I don't remember. It's in the standard prelude. Right. So it's in the standard prelude. Isn't NUB a lovely name, by the way? I quite like the name NUB, right? The people designing Java, if they had a library, it would be called No Duplicates in List. Right? But NUB is a lot nicer. So now, here we go. Let's write something that, given a proposition, tells us whether the proposition evaluates to true or false. So we'll call this eval, and it takes a proposition that returns a Boolean, true or false. But we need one other thing, right? Because the proposition might contain variables like A or B. So if you were asked to find out, is this true or false, you'd say, well, I can't tell you. First, you have to tell me whether A is true or false and B is true or false, and then I could tell you, right? So if A was true and B was false, what would the value of this parse tree be? Sorry, of this proposition tree be? False. Let's see. I need to check that. True and false is false. If this is true, not of true is false. If this is false, not of false is true. So we've got false and true, which is false. So these are both false, and false and or false is false. So it is indeed false. We could actually write that out, right, by writing next to the top of each tree what its value is. So that's what we're going to do. So first we'll need to do, given a list that pairs each variable x with a value y, find the value paired with that variable name. So we've done this before, right? Does lookup look familiar to everybody? You know how to do this? Right? Run down the list. We'll just look at each pair in the list. If the name matches the name we're looking for, return the corresponding value. That'll give us a list of all the corresponding values. We want just one, so it should be a list of just one thing. And from a list of just one thing, we return the one thing. So that's how lookup works. So we just look up the variable name in the environment. Then for false and true, right, they just evaluate to false and true. These are the built-in Boolean false and true, so I've written them out in full. Right, not of P, just evaluate P and return not of that using the Haskell function not. Similarly for OR, similarly for AND. So you remember we did an evaluator for arithmetic expressions last time, right? That was very similar. The literal N evaluated to N. The sum of two things will just evaluate the two things and add them. The product just evaluate the two things and multiply them together. So this side looks very similar to this side. Right, we're doing exactly the same thing here. Sorry, not there. Here. Right, so OR is evaluated with OR, AND is evaluated with AND, and so on. Is it clear to people how this works? And then if we give the stupid computer, right, just the proposition var A with an environment, let's see how this works. Right? So here's an environment that says A is false and B is false. So the name, right, the names in this proposition are going to be just A and B. So this is a slightly different environment. It's the one with A false and B false. So let's work that one out, right? This
would be false, false. False and false is false. Not a false is true. Not a false is true. True and true is true. False or true is true.
So with this environment, if we do eval in environment E0 of proposition P0, we get true. Right? And the way it's going to work is it's going to, given this expression, right, how does the stupid computer work? Right, we can just go back and look at eval. Right. So the argument P0 is going to be this whole expression here. That's going to go, which of these match? That's going to say this equation matches. It's an OR, right? It's going to ask what is P and what is Q? And P is going to be this expression here, the left subtree, and Q is going to be this expression here, the right subtree. And then it will evaluate P and Q in that same environment. So let's look at what happens with P. It'll go around again. P is now this subtree. So which of these five equations is going to apply? Will it be this one? Nobody knows. Okay. So P is var A and var B. Right. Does that match this equation? The last one, right? Not this one, not this one, not this one, not this one, not this one. The one that has an and is what's going to match. And then what are P and Q going to be? Right. P is going to be var A, and Q is going to be var B. So now P is var A, and I recursively call eval E on P. Does the first equation match? Yes. And what is X going to be? A, right? It was var A. So X is going to be the string A. So now we look up in environment E, X. So E is the thing that pairs A with false and B with false. And we look up A in that thing, and what do we get? False. Right? And you can see an example of that right here. If we look up A in E0, we get false. So that's the way it works. Is that clear enough to people? Okay. So now you know how to evaluate an expression given a particular environment. Okay. But we often want to create... Sorry, there's a question. Equality compares propositions by looking at the structure, the exact same way that we did with equality for shapes, say. Right? If you did equality on shapes, you don't look and see if they print the same string. You look and see if they're built with the same constructor, with circle or with rectangle. Similarly here, we'd look to see if they're built with the same constructor. When we're comparing strings, like variable names, in the environment, that does comparison of strings, of course. Right, so if you look at the definition of lookup, this uses equals. This is equality on strings in this case. OK. So now, right, what are you often asked about a proposition? Right? Is it a tautology? Or is it contingent? Or is it unsatisfiable? So how would you work that out? How would you work out if a proposition is a tautology or not? Right, you have to look at not just one environment, but all possible environments. Right? So if you have two variables, there are four possible environments, right? False, 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 true, true, false, and true, true. If you had five variables, there'd be 32 possible environments. If you have 10 variables, there are 1,024 possible environments. So what we need is something that, given the variables, returns all possible environments. So let's define that. So given a list of names, return all the possible environments built from those names. So the key line is, right, if we have a variable x and then some other variable name, so x is the head and x is the tail, what are we going to do? Well, there are two possibilities for x, right? Either x is false or x is true. And so that's the possibilities for x. How do we get the possibility for all the other variables? Recursion. Right, so we recursively call environments on x's. That'll give us a list of all possible environments. We take draw e from that list. So for each e, we've receded here by x is false and here by x is true. And then the only thing left to do is to say, what do we do for the empty list? Right, so what is the list of all possible environments for the empty list of variables? Well, this is easy, right? If you have something applied to the empty list, it always returns the empty list, correct? Everybody agrees with that, right? A function applied to the empty list always gets the empty list. Yes, I saw one nodding head. Excellent. Somebody shaking his head. You want to argue with me?
Absolutely.
Well, what should environments applied to the empty list return then, if it's not the empty list? Right, so not every function applied to the empty list always returns the empty list. Right? And in this particular case, we know we don't want to return the empty list. Because say we did. Say that environments of the empty list was the empty list. Then what would happen if we had one variable? Right, so there's one variable, there should be two possibilities, right? So we should get x paired with false and x paired with true for each thing in E. But if this returned the empty list, right, E drawn from each thing in the empty list, there aren't any, so we just get the empty list. You know that's how comprehensions work. Right, so this would be the empty list, and this would be the empty list. We'd append them together, and we'd get the empty list. So if we define environments of the empty list to be the empty list, then that gives the empty list. A list of length 1 also gives the empty list. Therefore, a list of length 2 also gives the empty list, and so on. This would always just give the empty list, which is probably not what we want. So what we have to do is define empty list properly. How many different environments are there defining no variables? There's one, the empty environment. Okay. So we return one thing, a list of one thing, and that one thing is itself the empty list. Now, wait a minute. You told me that the number of different environments for n different variables is 2 raised to the nth power. So what happens if there are no variables? Then n is 0. And 2 raised to the 0 is 0, right? No? What's 2 raised to the 0? 1. Right, because you multiply things together, so for no things, you use the multiplicative identity, which is 1. Right, a number raised to the 0 power is 1, because raising to a power is repeated multiplication, and 1 is the multiplicative identity. Right, so 2 raised to the 0 is 1, so for 0 things, we should get 1 environment, and here we're getting 1 environment. This is what we want. So could we prove that if we give this a list of length n, we always get out a list of length 2 to the n? Yes, this is very easy. We prove it by induction. In the zero case, if we give it the empty environment, it returns something of length 1, and 2 to the 0 is 1, so that's okay. In the inductive case, let's say the tail has length n. By induction, we assume that the environments of a list of length n returns a list of 2 to the n environments. So there are 2 to the n possible values for E. So this list will have 2 to the n elements, and this list will have 2 to the n elements. You concatenate them. You get a list with how many elements? 2 times 2 to the n, which is 2 to the n plus 1. Okay, so we've actually proved that this returns a list of the right length. Notice, here's an alternate definition. I just said return each pair XB for B drawn from B's and E drawn from the environment of X's. And B's is just the list false true. So these both do exactly the same thing. Let's see an example. Right, we know environments of empty gives the empty list. Environments of the list just containing B is going to be what? Well, what we will do is for each E in environments of the empty list, we'll return, in this case, X is B. So we return B paired with false and B paired with true for each possible thing here. And the only possible thing here is E is the empty list. And the only possible thing here is E is the empty list. So here we get B false const onto the front of the empty list. Here we get B true const onto the front of the empty list. But of course, this is just the list containing B false and nothing else. This is just the list containing B true and nothing else. So that's why environments of the list B returns the list that, of two environments, one pairs B with false and one pairs B with true. So now we have environments of AB. That, of course, is going to be A false onto E for each E drawn from environments of B, and A true onto E for each E drawn from environments of B. But environments of B is, of course, this list of two things. So we get E is going to be either B false or B true. So we have, what do we get? A true, if I got here. Right, A false on the front of B false. A false on the front of B true, A true on the front of B false, and A true on the front of B true. Right? So first we put all A falses on front of all these possibilities, and then A true. And that gives us the four possibilities we want. Okay? See how that works? So now we can get all possible environments. When would an expression be satisfiable? If there's any environment for which eval of that proposition in that environment returns true. And we can work that out just by taking the OR of all those evaluations. So this will be true exactly when the proposition P is satisfiable. You now really understand computation and logic. Right? So you know you understand a subject if you can pass the test in the subject. You know you understand a subject really quite well if you can take a friend and explain it to them. But you know you understand a subject perfectly if you can explain it to a computer. Because we've all seen how stupid computers are. So if you can explain it to a computer, you must understand it perfectly. If you can write a program that captures your knowledge about something, then you understand it thoroughly. There are few better ways of understanding something than to be able to write it as a compact and elegant program. And I hope you agree, right, that this is really pretty compact and elegant and wonderful. Right? The definition of names is pretty straightforward. The definition of eval is quite straightforward. lookup was something we already knew how to do. And then all we need to do is define all environments, right? It's just three lines long, four lines long, counting the type declaration, right? And it was very straightforward once you understood the pattern, which is for the empty list, well, there's only one environment, and otherwise take all the environments there are from the tail and put X false on the front or X true on the front. So it's really all pretty compact, right? And then just one line there, evaluate it in every possible environment and take the OR. So there's a, how long did it take you to learn about satisfiability in computation and logic?
A million years.
A million years. How many lectures was it? Was it one lecture, two lectures, three? Not sure.
Okay. One tutorial.
One tutorial. Right. So in here, in less than one lecture, we've seen how to write a program that encodes that knowledge and would do all your tutorial homework for you. So now we could do things like, right, here's P0. We know that names is A and B, so it's environments of names. It's all these environments. If we do eval of E for each of eval E for each environment of P0, right, in the each environment, we're now going to evaluate this expression. If A is false and B is false, we saw it was true. And if A was false and B was true, we saw it was false. If A is true and B is false, it will turn out to be false. And if A and B are both true, it turns out to be true. So then we, to find out if it's satisfiable, we just say, does true ever appear in this list? Right? Is there any environment for which it's true? And the answer is yes. So it is indeed satisfiable. Okay. Any questions about that? So your tutorial this week will be to, in fact, take this program and extend it so that you can do even more of your computation and logic homework. Question?
It's actually a question from yesterday. Mm-hmm. You mentioned that in defining patterns for functions, we could use, for example, n plus 1 or n plus 2. But
right.
From what I've read from the latest documentation for a standard, that's already impossible. For example, writing f and then n plus 1.
Right, good question. So I mentioned in the lecture yesterday that you could write patterns like this one or like this one. And I said this because I'm an old codger. And I remember how Haskell used to be defined. I mentioned I got this into Haskell. What I forgot to mention, because it's a painful memory, is they outvoted me later. And they removed it from Haskell. But there's a special flag. So if you say GHCI dash dash Phil likes this, then you get, no. I think you have to say dash dash n plus one patterns or something like that. If you look it up in the manual, it will tell you what to say. But you need a slight extension. So it will still do it, but you have to say, I really want this extra thing that's not part of the standard Haskell definition, because they did remove it from the standard Haskell definition. Okay, we're pretty much at time, but I want to show you something in the notes, because you'll want to see it. So I won't go through this in detail now, but I want to show you something else very quickly. A different thing you can do with a proposition is simplify it. And you could actually say, right, a proposition is going to be simple, right, that only consists of ands and ors, and the only nots are at the leaves. And a leave, you just have not of a variable or a variable, and that's it. So this is something that says, right, if it's not of something, that thing itself better be simple, and it better not have an operator at the top of it, such as not and an or. For ands and ors, you're allowed ands and ors underneath, right? And this will check itself that there's not underneath, and so on. And if it's anything else, if it's a variable or true or false, then it is simplified. If it's not, it must be of the form not of a variable and nothing else. Not true and not false are actually allowed here. Ah, that's wrong. Okay. And then this takes an expression and puts it in simple form by saying, right, take your expression, simplify it, and then if it's simplified to an or, well, you'll have to turn that into an and negate everything in it. If it's simplified to an and, you'll have to turn that to an or and negate the subpropositions. And then we can say things like, if our proposition P2 is not of P0, well, that's a not all the way at the top. We push that all the way down so that we get this proposition. The neat thing is there, I've defined an is simple, I've defined simplify. If only I could generate random propositions, I could use quick test to check that this works. So in fact, you can write code for quick check that will generate random propositions. I'm not going to go through this in detail. We'll explain it more later. But basically, we've said if it's of size zero, it better be true, false, or a variable. If it's size greater than zero, it can be true, false, a variable, or something recursively generated. I'll show you more about how that works later. But for the time being, you could assume, say, on an exam, if we gave you a question involving propositions, we would also give you the quick check code to generate random propositions. And then when you're doing your exam or your tutorial homework on the computer, you could test it by writing a proposition such as prop simplify of P, meaning after you simplify it, it should be simple. Right? A proposition for evaluating things should say that if we evaluate something and we evaluate the simplified version, they should both be the same in any environment. And then we can actually pass that test. So by just being able to generate random propositions, which is something we can do using quick check, you can automatically test that your code is correct. Okay, I've gone slightly over there. It's 12:01. Thanks very much. Enjoy doing your computation and logic homework as your functional programming homework. Why did they remove it? Of course, I love it, so I don't think they should have removed it. The argument that was given was that this one's more clear. But the one thing you need to know here.